Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. After shattering representational tradition with Cubism, which he developed with Georges Braque, Pablo Picasso became the artistic visionary against whom most others measured their creativity throughout the 20th century. Born in Malaga, Spain in 1881, Picasso attended art schools and aligned his sensibilities with Bohemian writers and artists in Barcelona and Madrid. After early work inspired by El Greco, symbolism, and the sinuous curvatures of Art Nouveau, Picasso began to find his own vision. The art he made from 1905 to 1915 unleashed a torrent of originality, culminating in the birth of Cubism, among the 20th century's most revolutionary art movements. As part of the series Celebrating the East Building, 20th Century Art, senior lecturer David Gariff explores the contributions made to 20th century modernism by Picasso, Braque, and their peers. This lecture was presented on July 24th, 2018 at the National Gallery of Art.
Okay, I think it's about time, so we'll go ahead and get started. Again, assuming that not everybody has been here for the previous lectures, what we're in the midst of doing is to take a sort of survey of the East Building permanent collections in sort of order, the way you would go through the building logistically, gallery by gallery. Once you come up the stairs from the ground level, you're on the mezzanine. And really, this would be the place you would start if you were continuing your journey from the West Building. You would really come here. And this would pick up the story, because the West Building collections end with post-impressionism, Cézanne, Van Gogh, Gauguin, Seurat. So to pick up the story of 20th century painting, you would really begin here. And we sort of outline for you the fact that you're going to see Cubism and Fauvism, because we have a painting by a Fauve, Kees van Dongen, here, and also a painting by a Cubist, Juan Gris, who we're going to talk about today. Again, in case you're not quite sure what this is all about, we give you another wall that sort of tells you, looking back to where you just came from, the West Building, and looking forward now to the 20th century, and the two dominant personalities are going to be, certainly in the first 50 years of the century, Matisse and Picasso. So we chose Picasso, Matisse, we chose two figural paintings, and we chose two paintings that are exactly from the same year, and they both are at the beginning of the 20th century, 1901. So this lays out where we're going. And in the case of both of these artists, where they start is not where they end up. So this is sort of showing you sort of their early work. So now we're going to go into the room that I skipped over last time, and that's the room that's now devoted to early Picasso. And we have a very handsome wall plaque, early Picasso from 1901. It's the same date as the painting that's out front of Pedro Menach. This is of Peonies, and this is housed now in these galleries. Things have changed a little bit since these photographs were taken. This ensemble has been broken up a bit. But you're into that front gallery, which will be early Picasso. So it'll be Picasso from the time he pretty much leaves Barcelona, comes to Paris, through the so-called blue period and rose period, and then you'll go into the next room, which would be when Picasso is beginning, along with Georges Braque, to develop the ideas and concepts that are part of what we call Cubism. So, in early Picasso, before Picasso is Picasso, let's debunk one theory, and that is that Picasso was a Cubist because he didn't know how to draw. So here are Picasso drawings at the age of 12. That's right, 12. Study of a torso after a plaster cast on the left from 1893. And these are charcoal with black pencil on paper, and study of a torso 1895 on the right. So Picasso is obviously a prodigy. I don't think he's quite Mozart, but he certainly is right up there. You know, Mozart was writing operas when he was still in his mother's womb. So Picasso is he's up there, but I think we have to give the mantle to Mozart. In any case, Picasso's born on October 25th, 1881. He's born in southern Spain in the coastal town of Malaga. His father was a art professor at the provincial school in Malaga. So he studies even when he's just at home as a child. His father's given him informal lessons, and Picasso's drawing from the time he's really 2 or 3 years old. Just drawing informally, shows a great talent, obviously. He studies at some provincial schools in Malaga, but the most important event for Picasso, and actually for his father, is when they leave Malaga, because nothing's going on in Malaga. So they leave and they go to Barcelona, where his father takes a teaching position. And this becomes pivotal in the young Picasso's life, because Barcelona, unlike Malaga, Barcelona is a very international city. It's closely tied to France. Almost all the great French artists who are exhibiting in Paris at some point or another are exhibiting also in Barcelona. It's a very vital, has a very vital avant-garde art community. So Picasso, that move to Barcelona is particularly important. These early works, these early drawings, he's working from, of course, plaster casts, which were part of the curriculum at an academy. Of course, he's incredibly precocious, obviously. Picasso and Matisse are two of the types of artists who could have been any type of artist they wished to be, no matter what. If they wanted to be a surrealist, if they wanted to be a classicist, if they wanted to be a romantic, if they wanted to be you name it, they could have. They had the talent to go any way and anywhere that they chose. Because they chose to go in the directions that they did is the result of very serious intellectual, artistic, aesthetic choices that they're making in an attempt to deal with certain problems that they're particularly interested in. So when Picasso comes to Barcelona, he is immediately aware and drawn to the Parisian artists who are there. And then by 1900, turn of the century, he's made his first trip to Paris. So now he's actually kind of shuttling back and forth, and he'll settle permanently in Paris in 1904. So up to that time, he's kind of going back and forth. So he's definitely aware of what's happening in Paris, what has happened in Paris at the end of the 19th century. So here we see, on the upper left is Pierre-Auguste Renoir's Dance at the Moulin de la Galette, up here, from 1876. It's at the Musée d'Orsay today. This is Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec's painting at the Moulin Rouge from 1892 at the Art Institute, Chicago. And this is the young Picasso, who is going to exactly the same places that all these guys went to, because he's, you know, on this little pilgrimage. So in the lower right is the Moulin de la Galette 1900 by Picasso, that's at the Guggenheim. So these two locations are the same. This is the Moulin Rouge, this is the Moulin de la Galette. So it may be the same place, but it sure doesn't look the same. And that is because, of course, Picasso is attracted to the avant-garde painters at the end of the 19th century who were part of the what we would call the demi-monde, the underbelly of Paris. The cafes, the bars, the bistros, where there was a kind of darkness, shall we say. So Renoir goes to the Moulin de la Galette up here on a Sunday afternoon. Everybody's, like I always like to say about Renoir, everybody's combed their hair, brushed their teeth. Everybody looks beautiful, handsome. The sun dapples through the trees. You know, everybody, it just looks so wholesome. Picasso couldn't have cared less about that. So when he goes to the Moulin de la Galette, it's not on a Sunday afternoon, he goes on a Friday night. And on a Friday night, every kind of person is coming out from under the rocks. It's a place that's much more interesting, obviously. There's a lot of stuff going on, and Picasso isn't shy about confronting mores and ideas. Here's a lesbian couple he puts right at the front of the painting. So he's not trying to sort of pull his punches or anything. And his real sort of inspiration is not Renoir, it's Toulouse-Lautrec. So when you come into the early Picasso room here at the gallery, remember I said to you last time that we've moved some West Building paintings into the East Building as kind of transitions. So for example, when you're in Fauvism, we have a Van Gogh painting there to show you that transition. When you're in the early Picasso, we have a Toulouse-Lautrec painting, a cafe scene that we've moved from the West Building into the East Building to sort of show you exactly this kind of connection here. So when Picasso is frequenting Paris now, of course, he's interested in especially the post-impressionists. So Toulouse-Lautrec, Van Gogh, Gauguin, Cézanne, Seurat, but he's going to all the salons. He's just absorbing everything that he possibly can. Here is the painting that hangs at the entrance that we just showed you, and this is the portrait of Pedro Menach, who was one of his early art dealers, who promoted Picasso's work in Paris when he first arrived in Paris, and also actually promoted his work even before that in Barcelona. So Pedro Menach from 1901, and then the Peonies, that still life that was hanging next to the sign, from the same year, 1901. And the thing about these paintings is, in essence, what I've just said. This is not the Blue Period, this is not the Rose Period, this is not Cubism, this is what we would call the Expressionistic Period of Picasso, when he is being expressionistic in the mode of Van Gogh, Toulouse-Lautrec. He's working with a very thick paint, active brushwork. They're very kind of more personal. In the case of the Menach, it almost looks like a poster, kind of flattens out in tribute to Toulouse-Lautrec's great posters. So his early sort of influences, the early influences here are expressionistic, shall we say. Barcelona to Paris is, Malaga to Barcelona, that's a big move. Barcelona to Paris is also a move that's fraught with difficulties, in part because when Picasso arrives, well, first of all, he's young, he has no money, and he doesn't speak French. That's pretty tough right there. He comes with a friend, Carlos Casahemas, who figures very prominently in early Picasso's early life. So very soon, both Casahemas and Picasso are essentially poor. They're starving, they're struggling, they don't really know anybody. They just speak Spanish to each other instead of going out and trying to learn French. And that, of course, begins in late 1901, the so-called Blue Period, shall we say. So here's the Gourmet on the left, which is the same year as Pedro Menach, but it's later. Now, by the end of 1901, he comes into this sort of blue, so-called Blue Period, 1901, and then the Tragedy on the right from 1903. These are both Chester Dale pictures. So in 1901, late in the year, Picasso's art takes a rather dramatic turn, and it begins with these, it really begins, and again, this is not technically a course on Picasso here, so I have to gloss over a lot of things, but it really does begin with several paintings that deal with and confront the suicide of his friend Carlos Casahemas. When Carlos Casahemas comes to Paris, he gets involved with a young woman, a seamstress. If I start this story, believe me, it's a long one. Her name is Germaine Pichot. She doesn't return his affections. And Casahemas is very depressed. Picasso knows this. At one point, Picasso decides to go back to Barcelona to see his family. He leaves Casahemas alone in Paris. Casahemas has a big confrontation with Germaine Pichot at a cafe, and then at a certain point in the conversation, he takes out a revolver, he aims for her and shoots, but he misses, and then he turns the gun on himself and kills himself. And this is, we have the entire police record of this event. When Picasso hears about this back in Barcelona, he's mortified because he feels, if I had stayed in Paris, I could have prevented this. I know he was depressed, I should have never left. And then that starts this series of paintings where Picasso is working out his grief, his sorrow, all these mixed emotions he had about the death of his friend. And certainly the Blue Period, the blue color, the blue tonality, does lend itself to these paintings that look somewhat solemn, somewhat melancholic. Of course, that's just one aspect of the blue. Blue is not an uncommon symbolist color in symbolist painting in France and in Spain, so there was certainly a more purely aesthetic connotation of blue. Historically, of course, blue has always been sort of associated with melancholy, you know, despair. I feel blue. that kind of thing. So all of that was working here. So it suited Picasso's frame of mind. So in the Blue Period, he does begin to portray these indigent people who are on the fringe, who are poor, dispossessed, young, poor, hungry people. Many of these people he's seen on the streets. They're begging for money, et cetera. And so they start to become the subject, which fits with his own kind of feeling of, especially after his friend's death, now he really feels alone, alienated, kind of lost. He feels like an alien, literally, in Paris now. So all of that gets translated into the Blue Period. So the brushwork, especially with the Gourmet, is still this very beautiful, active, expressive brushstroke. It's thick, there's a lot of paint. He pushes it around in a way that would be worthy of, again, certainly somebody like Van Gogh. He doesn't really show specific narrative. In other words, this isn't a particular young girl that we know in a particular situation. The paintings in both cases, especially with titles like Gourmet and Tragedy, they have a kind of universal, generic. They could be interpreted in many ways. Gourmet has an irony. This is a girl who loves to eat. She has nothing to eat. So she has this little piece of bread. And she's has this bowl of something, soup, milk, whatever. And in the case of the tragedy, well, what is the tragedy? Who are these people? We assume they're a family, a husband and wife and a young boy. So the overall feeling is, in certain ways, what we would call symbolist, and which is to say that it has a certain melancholy, a certain sadness, but that feeling is somewhat universal. It's not necessarily telling us a particular story. A lot of these Blue Period pictures, and more easily seen here, have these very thin, somewhat elongated figures, which in itself is very expressive. But of course, that's coming from also one of Picasso's great loves in terms of his admiration, and that was the work of El Greco. So Picasso was a great admirer of El Greco. He filled notebooks and sketchbooks with studies after El Greco. Some are literally after paintings by El Greco. Others are just variations and fantasies in which he's making a head that looks very much like an El Greco head with a pointy beard and all of those kinds of ideas. So these characters in the Blue Period kind of escape, you know, specific worldly narrative, but nonetheless, they have a certain universal symbolic, maybe even sometimes people think they're somewhat spiritual paintings. So here's the tragedy, and I thought you'd like to see, as I showed you when we were talking about Modigliani, where this used to hang in Chester Dale's house. It's right there. So this is Chester Dale's photo album that he kept. Remember, he had a house on East 79th Street in New York City, and all these, we can identify, here's to the track, and the guy, everybody we know, well, these are all in the gallery. So you should know all of those, but that's Tragedy there. Now, by far and away, the most important Blue Period picture is not at the National Gallery. The most important Blue Period picture is in Cleveland. It's this picture. This is La Vie. Life from 1903. I taught in Cleveland for 11 years, so I know this painting very well. And this is at the Cleveland Museum of Art. And every important thing about the Blue Period, about Picasso's autobiography at this point in time, his relationship with Casamigos, all of that gets filtered into this picture. This is also the largest of the Blue Period pictures. So we could really spend hours and hours deconstructing this, the iconography. He leaves many sketches for this picture, many drawings, preliminary sketches, and we know initially this figure of the man was a self-portrait of Picasso. And this woman with the baby was originally not in the concept, in the idea, it was a portrait of his father. And it was dealing with Picasso's, much like Cézanne, Picasso's desire to sort of please his father and to show him that he was worthy of being an artist. Along the way, and it's specifically after the suicide of Casahemas, that Picasso comes back to this painting, paints out his face, paints out his father, and now changes it to this couple. And this is very similar to the face of Germain Pichot. This is a portrait of Casahemas now, not Picasso. And you see these two paintings of these embracing couples here, and they look across at, and he points to a woman with a child. Trust me, there's a lot of meaning here that relates to this traumatic moment in time. So if you look at any important book on Picasso, Richardson's biographies, or Marianne Cause, or anybody, you can find out more about this. But this is the most important blue period picture. Probably the most important so-called rose period picture is the one that we do own, and that's the Saltimbanques, the family of the Saltimbanques. So as I said, in the spring of 1904, Picasso settles in Paris. He moves into this rather tumble-down studio in Montmartre. He frequents the same cafes as all of the sort of young avant-garde painters. And in fact, he has around him a circle of friends. They start to become now known as the sort of Picasso band or tribe or group. They're around Picasso. He's learned French. He's feeling much more comfortable. And more importantly, by 1905, he has made the acquaintance of Gertrude and Leo Stein. And we already talked about Leo Stein purchasing Matisse's Woman with the Hat, remember, when we were talking about the birth of Fauvism. Gertrude Stein leaned more towards Picasso. So they're brother and sister. They're from Baltimore. They're living in Paris. They have this very important salon where they invite all these avant-garde painters and writers, Hemingway, everybody, you know the story. And Picasso's part of that. And now, really, starting in 1905, Picasso's fortunes change. Financially, Gertrude Stein is purchasing paintings. She's introducing him to other collectors, dealers, Vollard, Kahnweiler, people like that. And so, more or less, from 1905 on, Picasso's pretty well off. So all of the Sturm und Drang and tragedy and grief and sorrow kind of gets packed into the first 5 years or so in Paris. And that seems to be reflected in this change in his style from the blue to the rose period, or sometimes it's called the circus period. Here's the wall, by the way, that we can see now. There's the Toulouse-Lautrec that we hang against the two that paintings I just showed you. So we have Toulouse-Lautrec here as the kind of appetizer showing you the relationship here. But certainly the picture that's at the heart now of this period is the Saltimbanques. So in 1905, Picasso pretty much abandons that blue palette. He abandons that somewhat melancholic subject matter. And he turns instead to these subjects. Again, they are, to a large extent, dispossessed, marginalized people, like those in the blue period pictures. But these are usually now clowns, performers, jugglers, saltimbanques, these traveling itinerant performers who go from town to town. And so that's why it's sometimes called the circus period, as well as the rose period. His palette changes from blue to these more pastel types of colors, pink, rose, that kind of thing. He is going to a particular circus, a very famous circus that all these artists went to. Everybody went. It's the Medrano Circus, M-E-D-R-A-N-O, the Cirque Medrano. So he watches these people. He knows they all live together in these little squalid kind of locations outside of the city limits. He's drawn to them. There is a certain romanticism here about the poor, the dispossessed here, that's coming from Baudelaire and even somewhat from Rimbaud. So he starts to take on these particular themes. And of course, this is the one where he probably sort of puts it all together. So this is our painting, Family of Saltimbanques, 1905. This is huge by Picasso standards. It's 7 feet by 7.5 feet. That's why I showed you people back here sitting in front of it, to give you a sense of the scale. This is the most, next to La Vie, this is the most important painting that Picasso created early in his career. And he shows these wandering saltimbanques as who kind of stand in some ways, for the idea of the poor, the dispossessed, but also more specifically, they stand in for artists. Picasso sees the plight of the artist as comparable to the plight of these people. We're poor, we're dispossessed, nobody accepts us. We have to kind of please a public in order to earn a living. We have audiences, we have to consider all of this kind of stuff. We're being harassed, we're being told we're not welcome in this salon or in that location. So he sees this as a sort of metaphor. And we already confronted this with, in Fauvism, Georges Rouault. Remember, Rouault was the one Fauve who was sort of the odd man out, who took on the same subject of clowns, saltimbanques, also prostitutes, things, because he felt similarly that they were comparable to artists. And almost 99% of the time when Rouault does a self-portrait, it's a self-portrait as a clown. He shows himself as a clown. So Picasso feels much the same way. He knew these performers. He met a lot of them in 1904, 1905. This background, which appears pretty frequently in early Picasso, which looks like just this vast, empty sand dune kind of location, is in part and parcel. There are actually locations like this that he traveled to, especially when he traveled, took some trips out of France and went to Holland, to the Netherlands. But in essence, again, these vacant landscapes are indicative of the fact that these people have no ties. They're not tied to a place. They don't have a hometown, so to speak. So that sense of being fixed to a location, to a family, all of that is somewhat sort of marginal here. He represents them almost always as a troupe. So they're a group. So within that, that is their security. They stay together as a group. They protect each other. They nurture each other. They joke with each other. And again, Picasso sees this comparably to the plight of the artist who seeks out other fellow artists to live this kind of life. This painting has been debated, discussed, analyzed, deconstructed over a long, long period of time. One thing he's showing us with these characters, especially this guy here on the far left, who wears the diamond patterned leotard, that's the character straight out of the Commedia dell'arte, this type of traveling troupe in Italian theater going back to the Renaissance and just after. And this guy, as you, I'm sure you know, is Harlequin. So Commedia dell'arte had standard characters. Pierrot, Harlequin, they all had a particular personality. They had a particular kind of trait. And what in the Commedia dell'arte, you could expect each character to behave according to his personality. So in certain stories, you would expect one person to behave one way and one another way. Harlequin was always seen as the trickster, the jokester. He was always causing trouble. He was mischievous. He would trick people and play practical jokes on people. And he would present one thing, but in fact, that wasn't the truth. Something else was the truth. So he would lie very often if it suited his purpose. So in this painting of the saltimbanques, this figure of Harlequin is a self-portrait of Picasso. And for the rest of his life, Picasso I shouldn't say for the rest of his life, but for a good 30 years, hence almost 40, he will identify with this character. So the reason it's important to study the blue period and the rose period is in part because of the iconography. Because he introduces us in these paintings to characters and tropes and symbols that will remain consistent throughout his career, but they will alter their visual aspect. So, for example, once you know that this is Harlequin with the diamond studded sort of patterned leotard, you may, in 1913, come across an analytic cubist painting, right? And in that painting, there'll be this little diamond pattern somewhere, right? Well, that's Harlequin. An analytic cubism, now he's just this little diamond pattern, like a piece of wallpaper. So you have to understand that's probably telling us something in that analytic work, if that's a reference back to Harlequin. So that is important in the Rose period. Some people think this large rotund clown is Apollinaire, who was one of Picasso's early champions. Some people think this kid is Max Jacob. I actually don't believe that. I don't think so. Some people say this is Fernand Olivier here. And then we get into this really, this story that's simply not true, but it's gotten so much traction over the years, that at this time, 1905, Picasso and Fernand Olivier were thinking about adopting a child. And in fact, they did adopt a child. They adopted a little girl. And as you might expect, Picasso was a horrible father. He really wasn't interested in spending time with this child, and on and on and on. And so they actually returned the child. They had to bring the child back to the orphanage. And some art historians, without checking chronology, have written about this painting as indicative of that. That this is Picasso. This is the child they adopted. Fernand Olivier is segregated. She's isolated away because of this incident. That's not true, because this adoption incident happened after this picture. So it couldn't have been painted in 1905. There are changes. You know this basket here? This little basket of flowers that has this really high handle. That looks kind of weird. And that's because originally this was a dog. when you look at the x-rays of this painting, she was petting a dog. And when Picasso got rid of the dog, he had to still keep that height. So he had to make this handle really long to come up to the same level as where her hand was. So this is a painting over which, about which, much has accrued. And you have to be very careful who you're reading, the sources you're reading, for all of Picasso. And you have to be very skeptical of what Picasso says. Because he'll say something in 1905, he'll contradict it in 1907, he'll say something different in 1913. Really, you can't trust him at all. So you have to go somewhere else. Now, this is, again, one of the largest Picasso paintings, and it was one of the largest paintings in Chester Dale's collection. Chester Dale bought this painting as well as the great painting by Manet, which in fact inspired, in part, this painting, the old musician that we have in the gallery. Dale bought both of those, and here's where the saltimbanques hung in his house. Going up the staircase. This is his house. This was the residence, which, thank God, is still in existence. They haven't knocked this down. In fact, today, or at least the last time I looked, it was an art gallery, and here it is today. So that's East 79th Street. And here he is. This is a poor quality because it appeared in Life magazine in October 10th, 1938, when he's coming up the stairs here. Here are two other paintings that would fall into this category of the Rose period or the Circus period. Juggler with Still Life, 1905, and Two Youths here from 1906. Both of these are Chester Dale pictures. So he very actively collected Picasso. Also George Braque. So you see the change in palette. There's a dramatic change in palette away from the blues. There's a change in sort of texture in paint application to a thinner, more scrubbed, more linear kind of portrayal. There's a greater emphasis on drawing, less emphasis on active sort of brushwork. This is a character, again, who stands in a kind of strange, all these characters still stand, they seem to stand in some kind of strange, amorphous, ambiguous kind of place. A juggler, again, is a performer, he's a circus performer, he has to please the public. So Picasso is still identifying with that idea. This is 1905, but this is 1906. And in a year, the one thing about Picasso is this guy never stays in the same place very long. And that's the mark of a great artist. I mean, he doesn't hit something, get to a place and say, okay, this is great. I'm good at this. Everybody loves this. I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. That's not Picasso. So he's constantly reinventing himself, pushing himself, and it's about problem solving. Okay, I think I've solved that problem. Let's find something else. So what you're starting to see by 1906, these figures, especially in the faces, is you're starting to see a movement away from the more purely expressive post-impressionist style that he inherits. And now he's starting to become attuned to some of the influences that are circulating in Paris that are not Western at all, but they're non-Western. African art, masks, oceanic art. He's reassessing his own Spanish prehistory and going back to Iberian sculpture, large eyes and simplified forms. And so that's already starting to percolate by 1906. And in our painting, you just sort of start to sense that. But of course, it's at the end of 1905 and into 1906, when this painting is being worked on, that he makes the big leap with this painting. So even though we don't own this, I need to at least mention it, because if without mentioning this, we kind of lose some of the other ideas. This is Picasso's portrait of Gertrude Stein. That's at the Met in New York from 1905-1906. We already mentioned the importance of Gertrude Stein and Leo as beginning to patronize Matisse and also Picasso. That now changes the fortunes of really both artists. Their work starts to sell. They're introduced to other collectors and dealers. By 1905, 1906, of course, Gertrude Stein always wanted her portrait painted by these people. She seemed to know that that would be good for the future. So Picasso does paint her in this fashion here. And here you see this now clear reduction. All of the expressionistic brushwork, the color and everything is reduced down to these sort of simple earth tones. But most especially what's important, Gertrude Stein was like a force of nature, and she sits in this chair and she kind of leans forward. She's coming right at us, very confident, very self-possessed. But it's the face that's the most crucial part. Because now he clearly is thinking about African art and the way the eyes don't match up, the sort of haptic quality when you cut this down the center, the difference on the right side to the left side. All of these aspects are now related to him being aware of and looking at African art, which was widely represented, certainly in the Ethnographic Museum in Paris, which was known as the Trocadero. At that time, you could go and see these things at the Trocadero, but now people were buying and collecting these things. And among the most important collectors was André Durin, the Fauve. And it was really Durin who was introducing African art to Matisse and then also to Picasso and others. So there's this mask-like quality. It also relates to Iberian sculpture. So this is his portrait for Gertrude Stein, and then she hangs this with the great Matisse. So here they are. So Leo buys this, her brother. Remember, he says it's the nastiest smear of paint I've ever seen. But then he bought it. And this is her portrait by Picasso. So right here on this wall, we have the beginning of Fauvism and of Cubism. I'm stretching it a little bit with Gertrude Stein, but nonetheless, that's where we're headed. So that's a strategic wall. Now, once he got this far, that sort of opened the floodgate, and now we have to talk about, of course, one other painting that we don't have at the National Gallery, but fortunately it's in the United States and you can see it, and that's the Demoiselle d'Avignon, which is at MoMA. So you can go to New York, see Gertrude at the Met, and then go see the Demoiselle at MoMA. This is June, July. We know exactly when he was working on it, June and July of 1907. Again, and here's a painting of these two nudes that in many ways, this is 1906, this is 1907. This painting here is a kind of pushing of this idea here. But what the difference is this. So if you were to add her face to this kind of image, you kind of end up with these guys, with these ladies here. So this is one of those paintings that I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say something new that hasn't been said about it. It is definitely a radical break from almost every tradition of painting prior, traditional perspective, traditional composition, space, treatments of the human figure, on and on. It depicts five naked women that you can count here, but they're on this flat, kind of splintered space, and you can go through and pick out the influences here. First, Egyptian art here, where you see in the Egyptians, of course, when they represented forms in profile, didn't do it in a way that related to nature, to the way we actually see somebody in profile. In profile, you would just see my shoulder, this one shoulder, and you would just see my slit of my eye. My eye isn't where my ear is. But the Egyptian worked from not a perceptual basis, but from a conceptual basis. I know we got two shoulders, I know we got two legs, I know we got two eyes. So everything got pulled, right? Like that Steve Martin routine, King Tut, you know, when he pulls himself across. So Picasso's giving you the full eye here, like in Egyptian sculpture, the full two shoulders, splaying the legs here. These two figures come right out of Cézanne, Cézanne's bathers. So he's echoing 1907. Remember, if you heard my Cézanne talk, 1907 is the great retrospective of Cézanne at the Salon d'Automne. Every artist who was worth anything went to that show. 56 paintings by Cézanne. So when Picasso is painting the Demoiselle, Cézanne is very much in his mind. This hand over the head, typical Cézanne bather. This painting is painted from left to right. He starts here and moves this way. And so these are the radical parts of the painting now, which clearly relate to African art and African masks, Iberian sculpture. These two really relate to Iberia. This is Egyptian, Iberian, plus Cézanne, and African. He's pulling all these things together. This still life is a reference to Cézanne here. This is, again, a painting that goes through many changes. Originally, there's a sailor coming in because he's going into a bordello. These are prostitutes. And the title, The Women of Avignon, Avignon does not refer to the city in France. Avignon was the red light district in Barcelona. It was the street of the prostitutes. So there was originally a young sailor. There were two men in this picture originally. He gets rid of both of them and ends up with what we see here. He's painting this, by the time he's painting this, of course, he has met George Braque. So Braque and Picasso meet each other by the fall of 1907. And this painting, if anybody should have understood this painting, it's certainly Braque, who was working pretty closely with Picasso. And of course, when Braque saw this painting, he was stupefied. He was intimidated. I think he was intimidated because Picasso had just taken such a leap here. But Braque immediately responded, if you know, I'm not showing it to you, but if you know his painting called The Great Nude from 1907, it's a direct response to this painting by Picasso. There was an eyewitness when Braque was looking at the painting about what he, because you hear a lot of things about what Braque said about this painting. One is that he told Picasso, stick it in the closet and don't take it out for 20 years. But the one quote that we know is for certain is true is when he said that looking at the Demoiselle it was as if someone had drunk kerosene to spit fire. That's how he felt about it. So both Braque and Durand, who also was around when this painting was pictured, at first were perplexed. Everybody was perplexed by the painting. They knew it was radical, but they were very, very supportive. This is 1907. Sometimes in the history of art, and this should be the history of music, literature doesn't have to be just the history of art, history of dance. Sometimes things move in an evolutionary way. You can understand, okay, this came from that, and that came from this, and this kind of takes us where we are. But other times there are these, what I call, great lurches forward. Somebody just lurches forward, and there's no... It's just so radical. This painting, I still think today would be that. This is not truly a cubist painting, but it's a painting that lurches us forward. It's not a sort of evolutionary thing. Somehow Picasso just lurched forward. And the comparable parallel very often to this painting in other realms of what we might call cultural lurches is the Rite of Spring in 1913 with Stravinsky and Nijinsky, the Ballet Russe. There was no evolution about that. That was Nijinsky and Stravinsky doing something that was a great lurch forward. And when you go through the story of that ballet and how the dancers thought Nijinsky was crazy in there, he's telling them, look, I know you're supposed to turn out, I want you to turn in. I know you're supposed to be up, I want you down, you know, all this stuff. It was just a remarkable radical moment. And so that's comparable to what we have with the Demoiselle. And to further make this point, evolution versus revolution, this is Matisse in 1907. So in the very same year, Matisse paints the Blue Nude that's in Baltimore, the Cohn collection, on the left from 1907, and Picasso paints the Demoiselle. Now, the Picasso is all revolution, and really the Matisse is all continuity. Matisse wants to see himself in the tradition going back to the Renaissance and going back to the reclining female nude, going back to the Arcadian tradition of the pastoral nude in a beautiful landscape, beautiful rhythms, etc., color. So they're going in two different directions here. And really, this is where Picasso is going to push things in a way that Matisse never does. I'm not saying Matisse isn't a great artist. He's a tremendously great artist. But in this sense of revolution, in this sense of radicalism, of reinventing things, Picasso has the upper hand. And that does take us to Cubism. So now, if you enter that gallery and you go not to the side over here, which is where we have Fauvism, but this side is where we have Cubism. So we see this great head that we have here, Fernand Olivier. I'm going to talk about sculpture a little bit later. And the wall I want to go to is this wall here. So this wall curls around. So here's the Fauve stuff, remember? And then you're just kind of walking across. This is German Expressionism back here now. We're going to go there on Thursday. And here you see two paintings, Braque and Picasso, hanging next to each other. And of course, here again, I didn't even know I had this. When you walk through this room, everything is pretty much still where it is except for one wall. And the one wall that will always be changing because it's going to be works on paper, which are sensitive to light, will be this wall. So now if you will go upstairs, none of these works are on display. There's a whole new set of them. I'll show you a few later. So this wall will be a rotating wall of Cubist or Cubist-related works, not necessarily just by Picasso or Braque. The reason that's happening, the reason Harry makes that decision, in fact, to put works on paper up, is because technically speaking, in the realm, especially of analytic cubism, we don't have a lot of paintings. We just received another one from the Corcoran, but technically speaking, we don't have 12 or 10 or 8 analytic paintings. So here are Picasso and Braque in their studios, 1908 Picasso, 1911 Braque. This is where I love the story where he never saw African art. It's like it's all hanging in his studio on the wall and everything. And he, oh no, I didn't know that until like 1930 or something. You know, so you just can't trust this guy. So when we talk about cubism, and again, I'm giving you a very sort of truncated analysis here. We essentially divide cubism up into three periods. At least I do. One is around 1908, 1909. That was what we would call the Cézanne phase of cubism, the Cézanne-esque phase. Then when we get to 1910 to 12 or so, we are into analytic cubism because it's all about dismembering the object. So that's more analysis. And then after 1912 or so, we would get into the phase that we would call synthetic cubism, synthesis. Analytic cubism kind of, this is very simplified, blows the thing apart. And synthetic cubism puts it back together in a certain way. That's one easy way to think about it. But clearly, for the beginnings of cubism, Cézanne is pivotal. So again, those of you who heard my Cézanne talk, I ended with images like this. This is Cézanne's painting of Mont-Saint-Victoire near the Gardin that we have here at the National Gallery from 1886. And this is Picasso in 1909, the houses of on the hill at Horta d'Ebro. So Cézanne, early Picasso here in terms of early in relationship to the development of cubism. And you remember, well, if you heard this, my Cézanne talk, the quote that I gave that I think is the most relevant when Picasso was asked about Cézanne, and he's asked about Cézanne a lot throughout his career. But the one that I think is the most important was when in 1934, when he was asked, he says about Cézanne, he says, quote, "It is not what the artist does that counts, but what he is. Cézanne would never have interested me a bit if he had lived and thought like Jacques-Émile Blanche." This was a guy who painted apples. "Even if the apple he had painted had been 10 times as beautiful. What forces our attention is Cézanne's anxiety." That's Cézanne's lesson. So Cézanne's struggle to reconcile the three-dimensional world onto a two-dimensional surface is the hallmark of cubism. Cézanne's investigation of multiple viewpoints, simultaneity, all of these things that Cézanne was already grappling with that were the source of his anxiety, Picasso recognized, and so did Braque. So here is Braque and Cézanne. This is Cézanne on the left, the Bibi Musquari from 1895. And this is Braque on the right, the Viaduct at Lestac from 1908. Now, let me demonstrate just in three slides this kind of chronology. So here on the far left is a Cézanne-esque phase of cubism, we might say. So this is the phase that would run really from the Demoiselle, probably, I said 1908, but maybe 1907 to 1909. And you have this type of painting by both Braque and Picasso. This is, again, the houses on the hill that I just showed you, that speak to this tension and anxiety in Cézanne. This is an analytic cubist work that we have. And this is analytic cubism would be from 1910 to, say, 1912, roughly. And that's where you get the most fracturing, broken, splintered, and hermetic investigation of this relationship of form to the surface, so that we get in analytic cubism, at the height of analytic cubism, especially around 1911, 1912, when Braque and Picasso are working together, they're painting and they see each other's paintings, there's a moment at which they can't even tell who painted what. They're not signing them, they're in the studio, and they really can't, did you paint that one or did I paint that one? Because in the analytic phase of cubism, the fracturing, the breaking of the object, the sort of splintering, the relationships of the two-dimensional, three-dimensional surface, the absence of color, a monochromatic kind of clinical painting is so pronounced that the sense of individual sort of brushwork or anything like that is getting really diminished, that even the artist can't figure, they can't remember who painted what. That's where people have trouble with cubism. Most people have trouble with analytic cubism because when they look at it and it says still life with clarinet, everybody's like, where the hell is that clarinet? I don't see it. I don't see it. Or it says portrait of Joe Blow or something, and I don't see anything. I don't see an eye. I don't see a nose. I don't see anything. Or a woman with a guitar. These kinds of things, trust me, it's in there. Because the one thing that neither Braque nor Picasso will ever embrace is complete and total non-objective abstraction. They will not become Kandinsky or Mondrian. For the cubist, for Picasso, it all starts with nature. I might abstract nature, but trust me, that was the starting point. The clarinet's in there. And so that's a big, big, Picasso did not like Mondrian's work, did not like the paintings of Kandinsky, especially at the Bauhaus, because that's a road that he thought you can't go down. Art still has to be tied to nature. So analytic cubism is the closest the cubists get to that, which then takes us to synthetic cubism. I love this work that we have. It's from Paul Mellon. It was in the Mellon show that we did not too long ago. This is called A Cup of Coffee. It's a collage, 1913. It has charcoal and white chalk. It's on green laid paper. This is actually the work, you wouldn't know it unless I told you, but when you look at this work very closely in the when we had it up, and it may still be up now, I'm not sure, you can see pinholes in this work, because initially he held it all together with pins. So the paper was actually coming out of the from the background. Of course, over the years, this is a huge conservation problem, an issue. Like, do we keep the pins? What do we do if we put it, you know? So we no longer have the pins. You can see the pinholes, but the work is fixed. The pieces are fixed in place. Now, I don't know, Julia, do you want to say anything about this? We have a conservator here. But this is synthetic cubism, which is, in some ways, pulling us back to the world we recognize. So how do we do that? With color, with shapes, with language, with words, with numbers. So in synthetic cubism, you begin to see numbers, fragments of words, jour for journal, bal, B-A-L, J-O-U, and these all of these things start to come back, and then we feel, okay, I think I got it now. So this is the way cubism develops, from the Cézanne-esque phase to the analytic phase to the synthetic phase. Now, we talked about Picasso. Braque is his partner in crime, right? But they're not working together, and they don't meet until 1907. And it's late in the year of 1907. So here's where Braque begins, next to Matisse, right? So we're back in the Fauvist wall. This is the port, I showed this last time, the port at Ciotat from 1907. Braque begins as a Fauve. He doesn't show with the Fauves until, he doesn't show at that 1905 exhibit, he shows at the 1906 Salon d'Automne along with Dufy. But even here, and again, as I warned you last time, one always has to be careful. If you know a guy ends up somewhere or a lady ends up somewhere, and then you look back earlier, you tend to create a Procrustean bed. You know, you're going to make him or her fit where they end up. But even having said that as a warning, this is very non-Fauvist in terms of construction. In other words, Braque likes structure, even when he's a Fauve. He likes things looking pretty solid. He very rarely puts you hovering over water like Vlaminck does. He'll give you the shoreline, someplace you can stand, that kind of stuff. So his stay with Fauvism is very, very brief, and here you see it, because this is Braque's harbor from 1909. This is a harbor, and this is a harbor, right? And now you see, by 1909, he certainly has embraced and moved even past Cézanne into the more, slightly getting into the more analytic realm. You can still make out the boat, the mast, here at the harbor. This is a beautiful, beautiful picture. It's small, but it really is a stunning picture. The treatment of the color, these sort of earth tones and umbers, and the way they sort of play off of each other as these flattened shapes, that's almost a tune-up for another work that you won't see up unless we do a special, if it's on that wall where we do the works on paper, but I wanted to show it to you. It's this work. It's the Aria de Bach from 1913. This is another Paul Mellon work. It was up during the Mellon show. Because this is a particular type of work that Braque creates, and really, in my estimation, he's the champion of this type of work. It's what's called a papier collé. Papier collé just means glued paper in French, papier collé. And now it's these very streamlined, almost ascetic, Spartan arrangements of these pieces of paper that are cut and glued with some charcoal drawing here. And they're very, very simple and clean and reserved, but they're so, so elegant. They have such an elegance about them. Even when he uses a script like this here. And don't be fooled, because when you see some of these sheets of paper, it's actually paper that has very often imprinted on it a pattern. One type of paper is called faux bois, and that means false wood. So it looks like it has a wood grain. You know, like you could buy it to put wallpaper up or make a desk look like it's wood if it was metal, that kind of thing. And others, faux marbre, false marble. Braque begins as essentially an interior decorator. He works in design inside homes. He's painting walls, doing decorative work, wainscoting, all these little moldings and things. So he has a great sensibility about the decorative arts. And these are the kinds of papers that decorators use, these false surfaces. They use these repeatedly. So he would buy this stuff in gigantic rolls, and then he could just snip it out and then glue it. So this little pattern of grain, that's not painted. That's right in the, it's commercially produced paper. You know, Braque's desire was to be a house painter, and I mean literally, to paint houses. His father had been a house painter, his grandfather had been a house painter. He really wanted to just, I like painting houses. And then he just took a slight sort of detour. Here is Braque with Chester Dale. This is probably around 1945. There's Braque, Chester Dale. So they had a great relationship. And again, not only, that was the very first room we talked about when we were looking at those later Braques from the 20s. That's when Dale was really purchasing a lot of paintings by Braque. The works that we have are especially from the 20s and 30s. And the last cubist who should not be dismissed in any way is Juan Gris, because he is, again, in some ways, I mean, he doesn't get the credit and that he really should. This is a portrait of Juan Gris by Man Ray on the left from 1922. And this is a portrait by Modigliani of Juan Gris from 1915. This is at the Met, and this is at the Getty in Los Angeles. So Gris is born in Madrid, but he lives almost his entire life in France. He moves to Paris just 2 years after Picasso. Picasso settles in Paris in 1904, although he'd been going back and forth. Gris goes in 1906. He meets almost immediately Modigliani, Matisse, Georges Braque, and Fernand Léger. Those become his close circle initially. Through them, of course, he does meet Picasso. Picasso has an interesting relationship with Gris. In some ways, he's jealous. He knows Gris is good. And even in conversations that he, whenever one of his paramours, one of Picasso's paramours wanted to get at him, she would say something like, you know, that Gris, he's really got talent, you know, or gee, you never thought of that, that kind of thing. That would really get under his skin. But having said that, he was a fellow Spaniard, just like Picasso helped Joan Miró when he comes later. So Picasso was supportive of Gris. He knew he was good, and he is good. And the thing that's different about Gris, and here's the great still life that we have at the entrance to the modern art section now. This is Fantomas, and this is a poster that relates to it. I'll explain in a second. So this is the great still life by Gris from 1915 called Fantomas. Fantomas was a silent film, a French silent film, that was actually based on a novel. The film was serialized, so you had to go, it was in five parts, you would go, it was a serial. And it was one of those cliffhanger films, you know, they would just, the guy's falling off the cliff, and then you come back and he's still falling off the cliff, but then somebody catches him or something. And it was about, it was a crime film, the novel and the film, it was a crime series. And the protagonist was a guy named Fantomas. He was like a phantom. Here he is. He strides over the city. And he was a shapeshifter and could change his demeanor and the way he looked. And he could become invisible and then visible again. So that was the whole idea. And that is the reason, partly, that Gris takes this title for his painting. because that's how he feels about cubism. We're sort of shapeshifters. I show you a little thing here, then all of a sudden it's gone, then it peaks again out here, then it's over there. This is a clue over here, but if you follow that clue, you're not necessarily going to solve the puzzle. So all these things, this is a perfect synthetic cubist work, 1913, the use of words now, Le Journal. Here's the direct reference. Notice the mask here. So he's directly relating this to popular culture, to both the novel and the film. And what is so different about Gris, I think, is the clarity. When you look at a Gris, it's like there is such clarity and precision and in Gris that it's not in Braque and it's not in Picasso. He was very fascinated with math and mathematics. So everything in a Gris painting is working off of some kind of mathematical formula that he's creating or trying to follow. But the thing that's so evident when you look at a Gris painting, as soon as it looks so clear and sharp, almost always you're looking at a Gris, and it's not so much a Picasso or a Braque. So here's an artist, you know, who you come up with counts in the history of art. You know, if you're coming up with Picasso, that's a tough road to hoe. And I think Gris suffers a little bit as a result of that, but he's a tremendously important painter at this time. And then I just wanted to show you that wall. This is Lipschitz, we're gonna come back to him later. But here's the wall that has our analytic cubist works now, the Picasso and the Braque. And then just by to end, if you continue around that room, you can just peek over here. And these are now currently some of the works that are on this wall. So they're not even by Picasso or Braque. This is Paul Klee on the left. Persian Nightingales from 1917. This is a gouache with watercolor. And then in the center is Kasimir Malevich, the great Russian, from 1913. A peasant woman goes for water. So we've got Swiss, Russian, and that's an American, Stuart Davis, abstract composition from 1921. The thing that this shows you and that wall shows you now is what you very often hear about cubism, and that is that it is the parent of all abstract art forms of the 20th century, and in many ways that's true. Everything here is indebted to cubism. Even though Malevich is a suprematist in Russia, Klee is part of Blue Rider, Stuart Davis is an American, nonetheless cubism will sort of affect the subsequent history of abstract painting in the world. Okay, I was only 15 minutes over. That's good. See you next time.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.